members of the church, education is not merely a good idea. It's a commandment. We are to learn of things both in heaven and in the earth and under the earth. Things which have been, things which are, things which must shortly come to pass, things which are at home, things which are abroad.
Hello, welcome to Insights. I'm Marilee Stallings. Our guest today is Dr. Thomas H. Fletcher, a professor in the Department of Chemical Engineering at Brigham Young University. Welcome, Dr. Fletcher.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We're glad that you could come and join with us today. Your research area, according to your website, is combustion. Is that right?
It's combustion and energy, I guess you could say.
And when most of us hear that word, I know I think of really big explosions like the pyrotechnics that we see in movies. But as I thought about it, I was reminded of an incident when I was a child. We had a fire in our home, which gutted the kitchen, and it smoke damaged the rest of the house. This all came from a match my little brother lit, which started the fire, and it, you know, of course, engulfed the cabinets, you know, going up in flames, and I would assume that that's combustion. Is that right?
That's true.
So I am interested in today's topic because I do have firsthand experience of that, and I think we all do. But first of all, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into this volatile field.
Okay. It was kind of by accident. My father was a professor at BYU. He taught mathematics for 40 years, and I started out as a math major. And the day that they taught me, after about 2 years, that there were different sizes of infinity and that it mattered, and we used it in proofs, and I said I needed something a little bit more practical, and I switched to physics, and I don't know. I just didn't click with me, and I had a friend that was in chemical engineering and talked me into trying that, and I really liked it. And I'd been teaching at the MTC in Spanish and then worked at as a janitor at 4 in the morning trying to earn some money, and then a job for a company that made artificial diamonds, Mega Diamond. And I said, I need something on campus in my department so that I don't have to work all these crazy hours. And so I applied to a couple of different research groups, and I made it to the final two in one of the groups. And finally, I got a job with Dr. L. Douglas Smoot in the combustion field. And that's how I got into combustion as a junior in college. And it stuck, and I stayed there and got a master's and a PhD, and been in it ever since.
It's interesting that we've had several of the people that we've interviewed mention how they just kind of fall into their field by accident. And I kind of fell into my own field by accident. So you're in combustion. So what exactly is combustion? What makes things combustible?
Well, there's a lot of chemistry involved, and we kind of think of combustion as using oxygen to burn something that makes a flame. That's the kind of the classical definition of combustion, but it can cover a lot of different fields, from something we're trying to make electric power from or make things move, so transportation, or a fire that, like in your house, that was an accidental fire, or a forest fire. So combustion involves a lot of different things.
So when you talk about chemicals, so it isn't just oxygen that's involved.
No. If you're taught in elementary school that to have a fire, you have to have oxygen and fuel and heat to get it to go. That's how you start a fire. Well, even on a chemistry level, all of those things need to happen.
So what are some common combustibles?
Well, thinking of energy in the world, 85% of all of the world's energy to do things comes from burning something. So it comes from fossil fuels. So that means coal or natural gas or oil are the three big things that we burn for useful things, to make electricity or to make cars or trucks or trains go. And that comes from burning the fuel.
Now, my mother, so this kind of blows me away because this is just one generation ago. My mother grew up in a log cabin until World War II. And they had a wood cook stove and a wood pot-bellied stove.
Right.
And so that was their combustible, I would assume.
Sure.
And it was a lot of work.
It was a lot of work. And it was renewable so that they could you can grow more trees, certainly on a certain amount of time. But to do it on a large scale, we needed fuel that was more compact, that was something we could transport efficiently and get a lot more power than just heating a single home. And the scale is enormous of the amount of energy that's produced in the world.
Well, yeah, you just think about just the United States alone, and we consume a lot.
We consume a lot, yeah.
And then and all the developed countries, they consume a lot as well.
Right. And can you imagine trying to heat every place in Salt Lake City, for instance, by burning wood? Well, there's not enough wood around to do that.
No,
and
no,
so,
there's not.
We just can't do that anymore.
So the common combustibles then are coal.
Coal.
Oil.
And natural gas.
And natural gas. Those three are the common combustibles.
Those are the big three. And then there's, you know, we do burn, we lump wood and other things like that into something called biomass. And so that could be leftover corn stalks. It could be nutshells. It could be sawdust that's left over from some kind of milling shop or something like that. And we lump all of those into something called biomass.
Oh, okay. So anything that grows.
Anything that grows or even that's a waste product. They've been trying in Texas in the big livestock yards. They have a lot of animal waste. And they're trying – it has value that's energy value. And so –
because it puts out methane gas.
It puts out methane gas, but also what's left over, the residual, after you dry it and that has some fuel value, and they're wondering if they can convert that into some useful product, either by burning it or by transforming it chemically into something that might be a transportation fuel.
Well, the pioneers crossing the plains would go out and
<That's>
pick
right.
up buffalo chips.
Buffalo chips, that's right. So kind of – but if you can do it in a more efficient manner than in an open campfire, then that's what we're talking about, and on a huge scale. So it's a big problem in Texas – of what to do with this stuff. And so if they can use it for a useful thing rather than landfill it and worrying about if it leaches and enters the water supply or something, and then it'd be nice to convert it into a useful product.
Wow, that's really interesting. So we now know all the combustibles that are – they're more efficient, they're more – they're easier to transport, such as coal, oil, natural gas. How have we harnessed – because these still are natural products. We pull them out of the ground.
Right.
So how have we then harnessed these combustible materials? Is that a question that makes sense?
Yeah, I guess so. Certainly the economies of scale is one of the things that we've done. When we first started burning coal, it was in a wood stove kind of thing or a coal stove, and it wasn't very efficient. We're just making heat. But to make electricity, we have to – first make heat and then make steam and then have that turn a turbine, which turns a generator that makes electricity. And the first power plants to do that were very inefficient, maybe as low as 5 or 10% efficient. 10% of the heating value of the coal actually made it into the electricity.
Wow.
And by building bigger facilities that could go to higher temperatures and higher pressures in the turbine, we can get the efficiency up. But still, for just a regular coal-fired power plant, for instance, we only are 34% efficient. That means we're wasting 66% of the energy that just goes out into the world and is wasted.
It literally goes up in smoke.
Goes up in steam, basically, not
oh, okay.
in smoke, because they don't. That's a pollutant. They're trying to reduce pollutants. So, for instance, there's two power plants in Delta, Utah, that are kind of nice to visit, actually. But the inside of the firebox of these two power plants is bigger than the church office building. So when we're talking the economies of scale, they're huge.
Wow!
And each one burns 1 million pounds an hour of coal.
Wow.
And that's all shipped to Los Angeles they convert the power from AC to DC, if that means anything to you, and then ship it by lines down to the LA Basin and then reconvert it to AC power, and it supplies about a third of the power to LA and to Pasadena and Riverside, a few cities down there.
A couple of years ago, I went on a road trip with my parents, and we were crossing Wyoming. And as we were crossing Wyoming, which, you know, that high desert plateau, there's a whole lot of not much for hours. But as we were driving...
That's why we call it the plains, right?
Yeah, it is. It's literally the high desert plains. But off in the distance, we saw this huge tower. And I was like, what's out here in the middle of nowhere? And as we got closer, it turned out it was this massive, huge, open coal mine. It was an open pit coal mine. It was absolutely massive. And so as far as coal reserves in the United States, it sounds like, anyway, from what I was seeing there, we have plenty.
We have lots of coal in the United States. And the most popular coal right now, because it's cheap, is the coal in Wyoming with these open pit mines. And sometimes the seams are maybe 100 to 300 feet deep.
Wow.
They remove the overburden, and then they can just truck it out, put it on trains, and ship it all over the United States. Now, it is a lower-ranked coal, so it doesn't have as much heating value, and it has a different kind of ash. So when they try to burn that in a boiler that was designed for a higher-ranked coal, it causes some problems. And so that's what engineers are trying to work through, and sometimes trying to tell the managers, well, even though that's cheaper, that's in the long run going to wear out our boiler and cause some problems.
And so it's important to have people who understand how these things combust, how they, you know, what's the chemical compounds that are within the coal, and determining grades. That's really something. Coal isn't just coal.
No, there's lots of kinds of coal.
And there's probably lots of kinds of oil and lots of kinds of natural gas, too.
The natural gas, the variation in the natural gas is smaller than, I would say, than in the coal or the oil. But, yeah, there's certainly the pollutants in the natural gas are what differentiate it. But the basic component of natural gas is the same. It's methane. And then depends on how much sulfur or CO or CO2 or something else that's in the natural gas that defines it.
Thank you for joining us on the Mormon Channel. This is Insights. Our guest is Dr. Thomas H. Fletcher, professor of chemical engineering at Brigham Young University, and our topic is combustion. Now, developed and developing countries use a lot of fossil fuels. We've talked a little bit about that. How is this beneficial?
Well, you tend to want to not pay a lot of money as a developing country for energy costs, and you try to use what you have in your country. I went to a conference once. The conference was actually in China, and there was a person there from Bangladesh, and this was the first coal conference they'd ever been to, and they'd actually discovered a little bit of coal in kind of the northern part of Bangladesh, and that was their report. It wasn't really the most appropriate thing for this conference, but they were so excited that they had some natural resource for energy in their country that they could use. And so you don't want to import energy if you're a developing country because it costs too much. So you're going to use what's there. If you have coal, you're going to use coal. That's what China's doing. If you have a lot of natural gas, then you're going to use that natural gas. That's kind of what Russia has right now. If you have a lot of oil, like in the Middle East, then that's what you're going to use, and then even try to export that. So other countries, for instance, Brazil, they have some of each of those, but they also have a large biomass, which we talked about, component. And some of that comes from their sugarcane industry, and they can burn the leftover components of the sugarcane, which is called bagasse, B-A-G-A-S-S-E, and they can use that as an energy source, and that's renewable, so they're very happy with that. Now, it doesn't replace everything, and there may be 20% of their energy comes from renewables, but that's pretty high for the world.
You know, sometimes when I think about the combustion, we think about our automobiles and we think our buses and transit systems, because a lot of them are gasoline powered. And so that comes from the oil and stuff like that. But I don't necessarily think about the electricity I use as coming from a combustible. And right. We use electricity. I'm sorry, but I like my microwave oven, and I love my dishwasher.
And your air conditioner.
Oh, absolutely.
Which is maybe the most use of your electricity in your home. So 50% or over 50% of the electricity in the United States is developed from coal, and about 30% or so from natural gas, and about that same amount from nuclear power.
How much is from hydroelectric?
Probably about 8%.
So in that relatively small.
Relatively small. And then from biomass, probably about 1%.
Wow. So we really are dependent on coal and gas.
And the scale is enormous.
To run your computer.
Oh, yeah. Then you have to charge it, right, with electricity. Or everything you do uses energy, right, to make the clothes that you wear or to prepare the food before you cook it, just to get it to you, to transport it there. We're so dependent on energy. We just don't think about it. It's just automatic for us, but somebody has to think about it.
And that's what you're here for.
Well, I'm in that field.
Others. Yeah. So then with all of the use of this fossil fuel, how is that detrimental?
Well, each fuel has its own challenges and economics, okay? And so there's environmental impacts of everything we do, and there's economic impacts. And so, you know, which is worse, I guess you could say. We have solutions that are very expensive and would maybe cripple our country if we went solely to that. So we're trying to gradually move to things that are more environmentally acceptable. Some of the things that have been done for coal-fired power plants are to put on massive cleanup units for the trace amounts of pollutants that come out. The sulfur, for instance, in coal is something that we don't want, and so they have big scrubbers at the end of the exhaust streams of these power plants to remove the sulfur. Back in the day when that wasn't the case, say in Pittsburgh or in London, when they had no environmental controls or little environmental controls on these power plants, there was a lot of soot in the air and people would have a lot of respiratory diseases. And there was one big fog in England that, because of all of the pollution from the coal-fired power plants, they had thousands of people die in a few-week period that was attributed to the pollution that came from burning coal specifically.
You know, you mentioned, and I do have a quote here. This is actually from 1661, from John Evelyn, I'm trying to figure out how to pronounce, from Fumigium? No, Fumifugium.
I'd have to look at it, I guess.
I know. But anyway.
Back in that day, they didn't know the chemistry very well.
Yeah, they didn't know the chemistry very well. But here's his statement on London's air pollution from 1661. Her inhabitants breathe nothing but an impure and thick mist accompanied by a fuliginous and filthy vapor, which renders them obnoxious to 1,000 inconveniences, corrupting the lungs and disordering the entire habit of their bodies, so that catarrhs, physics, coughs, and consumptions rage more in this one city than the whole earth besides. And I think it's interesting that he also points out that you could smell London before you ever saw it. And so, well, that's one of the problems.
That's one of the things. And in developed countries, we have come a long ways, and we've been able to develop systems to take that all out of the air, and or most of it, like 99.9% of things, of the particulate or of the sulfur, a lot of the nitrogen compounds that make NOx that would cause air pollution. Mercury we've been working on lately. There's like one part per billion of mercury in coal. But if you're burning 1 million pounds an hour, then that's a source of mercury that we have to think about. We've been able to put on a lot of pollution control equipment. Perhaps 50% of the cost of an electric power plant burning coal now goes into the pollution equipment to clean up things.
I remember as a small child, I grew up in Idaho, and we made a trip down to Salt Lake City. Well, in North Salt Lake, there is an oil refinery, and this was the 1960s, and I remember as we drove down I-15 towards Salt Lake City and we passed that refinery, it was a gray fog. It was this gray fog, and it smelled horrible. And I remember as children, as we were scrunching down in our seats with our shirts up over our noses, going, "Ooh, Daddy, Daddy, this is awful."
Right.
And today, of course, it's not like that at all. It's much, much better.
Much better, and still maybe some ways to go. But, yes, we've come a long ways. There were times back in the 60s in Cleveland that a river caught on fire because of all of the chemicals that had been dumped in the river. Well, we don't do that anymore in the United States. In third world countries, they're still coming up to speed to be able to put the financing into the pollution control equipment. They have the advantage that the technology's already been developed so they can pay for it and adopt it so they don't have to go through as much. But they still have to first get the money from selling energy, then put it into the cleanup. And that's what China's doing right now.
So how did nature make these fossil fuels? Coal and oil.
Okay. Coal and oil came from, we think, a different pathway.
Mm-hmm.
Coal came from plants that were in all of these marshes, and they were reeds and sedges and not the very woody trees, but the ones that they would fall into the water and start decaying and then get some digestion first with aerobic, that means with air possible, and then they'd get buried by water and then a little bit of anaerobic digestion. Then that would be covered up with mud, and then it would go farther down in the earth, and the temperature as you go down in the earth increases, so it kind of cooks it a little bit and makes it fossilized and pressure a little bit too. And that's where we got coal, from these big marshlands that were back in prehistoric times. And there was just tons of vegetation, and that as it decayed and, you know, plants get old and then they fall over and fall into the marshlands, and that's how we kind of got coal.
So you also need to have a little bit of geology as you're studying combustion.
Well, if you're studying the history of coal, it's certainly, or where it came from, it does interface with the geology. With oil, it came more from the small animals that were in the ocean. And so most of the oil, we think, comes from the plankton and other things that settles to the bottom of the ocean, gets covered, then starts the fossilization process. Oil has a lot more hydrogen in it than coal, and that's why it's a liquid. And the leftover other components from the plants, coal has oxygen in it, believe it or not, where oil has very little oxygen in it. And depending on the rank of coal, if it's a very high-rank coal, it doesn't have much oxygen. If it's a low-rank coal, which might be a peat or a lignite, it has a lot of oxygen that's left over from the original plant material. And when you burn the material that has oxygen in it, the oxygen doesn't add any heating value because it's already oxygen. If you can't add oxygen to oxygen and get any heat. Yeah. So if it has the more oxygen in it, it has, then the lower the heating value, you don't get as much heat per unit weight of the fuel. And so we call that a lower grade fuel.
Now, I've recently learned that coal and oil can actually be manufactured from plant material. And it doesn't take millions of years, just a few weeks in the right temperatures and the right environment.
Never heard of coal being manufactured like that. Maybe I just maybe not have heard of that. But certainly we're getting oil or oil-like substances from lots of different sources. Right now there's a big effort to do it from renewable sources. They're trying to get oil when you grow algae in certain ways and press it, and you can press the oil out of it. If you treat biomass, so sawdust or something like that, in the right way, then you can get some hydrocarbons out of that that can be turned into oil. You can get oil from coal if you do it right. And the Germans in World War II, a lot of their fuel for their war machine came from gasifying coal, which is a little bit of oxygen and then steam, where you treat the coal, get it high temperature, and then the steam actually converts the coal into hydrocarbons, and then through some other treatments they can get out a kerosene-like substance. And they're starting to think about that now as transportation fuels become more expensive. Maybe this is a way to get transportation fuels on a large scale.
Hmm. So are there any other technologies that you see on the horizon that could be beneficial?
One that's come up that you may not be aware of in the last couple of years, just in the last 2 or 3 years, we were really worried about natural gas. Natural gas prices were going high, and we're gearing up to import a lot of natural gas. We're starting to build ships that could transport liquefied natural gas from the Middle East and other countries to the United States and have terminals in the so we could offload that. And people were worried about those terminals being targets for terrorists because it's like a big bomb, right? And yeah. We've discovered something. We knew it was there, but we've discovered how to get natural gas out of shale. Now, shale, here we go with geology again, but they call it shale gas. And what they've been able to do is drill down into the shale and directional drill. So they do kind of a horizontal drilling along the seam of the shale. And then they can fracture it by putting in water with some other compounds. And they can pressurize that in a way that fractures the rock and lets the natural gas seep out through the hole and come out. And 3 years ago, nobody was doing this, and now it's supplying about 20% of the natural gas in the United States. That's huge. And it's in areas that are very convenient to where people live. It's in New York, upstate New York, all over it, in Pennsylvania. It's also in Texas, and it's also in eastern Utah and Colorado and Wyoming. So nothing in California, unfortunately. But they're starting to produce that, and it's kept natural gas prices stable in the United States, so we don't have to go to the expense of importing natural gas.
That's great.
And it's clean. Natural gas is much cleaner than coal in many aspects, with the pollutants, and also as people are worried about CO2 emissions, then it produces per energy less CO2 emissions. So we're very happy that they've been able to produce this.
You know, I think energy has always been an issue, not just, you know, in our modern day and age. You think about all the civilizations that are past, they all run on some type of energy, whether that energy be food and their agriculture, being able to heat their homes. I think that's always been an issue. And so consequently, pollutants in fresh air have always been an issue too. I remember when they found up in the Swiss Alps, they found a mummified primitive man. They figured he was about 5,000 years old. And they did an autopsy on this mummified body, and they found out his lungs were just black. And then it dawned on them that, you know, that living conditions back then were not very healthy either, because when it's cold, you go inside and you burn wood and
And you're breathing the smoke.
And you're breathing the smoke.
Which is what they're still doing in some of the third world countries. In Africa, they have these huts that the natives cook in, and there's really not good exhaust, and so the insides are black, or in South America sometimes. And we actually have a professor, or many people, but there's a professor in our department that's working on better cook stoves and also ventilation to maybe, for very low cost, be able to find something that these people could use and that would increase their quality of life.
That's incredible. That's great. I'm glad you brought that up. You're listening to Insights on the Mormon Channel. Our topic today is the chemistry of combustion with Dr. Thomas H. Fletcher from Brigham Young University. Okay, we've talked globally about combustion. Let's look a little closer to home. I noticed that you've written a lot of articles that deal with wilderness fires. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. We call them wildland fires. We had a former student from BYU who's working for the Forest Service come to us a number of years ago. His name was Brett Butler. He works up in Missoula for a fire Forest Service research station. And they're trying to figure out better ways to help fight fires. These are the fires that might occur in Southern California in the Chaparral or in the forests up in the northern part of the United States, say in Montana or Idaho or something like that, or even in Utah. And a lot of the models, computer models of how fire spreads were developed from experiments on just laying down dead fuel, say pine needles or leaves, on beds and lighting one end and then either putting a wind on or maybe having it with an incline on a hill or something and developing correlations and developing a computer model of how fast will fire spread. Now, a bed of dead stuff doesn't really look like bushes that are 3D out in the hills in Southern California. And they came to us and said, "Well, you guys are combustion guys. What could you do?" And so we made a proposal, and we started a little project, and the students developed some experiments. And the goal is to really give some better tools to the fire managers that are telling the firefighters where to go so they can be safe, to see what they can save and to see where the fire is going so that they can evacuate people safely, and also perhaps what they can do around their houses. How far back do you need to keep the vegetation? What other things can you do to try to keep your house safe? So if there is a fire, maybe your house will be able to not be consumed, right?
We don't want it to go up in flames.
Right. But that's the problem, is people like to live out, we call it the wildland urban interface, WUI. So there's lots of conferences on fire in the wildland urban interface. And, you know, some communities, they have laws that say you can't put on a shake roof. And that's helped. So if they have a metal roof, then when things land on their roof, it doesn't burn as well. Other things that they've found, for instance, they recommend that under the eaves of the houses, a lot of these are log cabins, and so they have eaves that come down, and then there's a space under the eave that things that get blown by the fire can get caught, and then they start burning the house. And so if you put in some wood to kind of cover that so there's no place for flying branches to get caught, then that helps resist the home from burning. There's all kinds of things. Now, what we've done, we've been doing more sciencey thing. They said, we want some more science into these wildland fires. And so we started with just burning individual leaves. They'll cut fresh leaves down in Southern California, FedEx them to us, and we'll burn them the next day and try to start from very almost fundamental kinds of things and see if then we can – right now we're using those data to try to model a bush. I love the kind of the nickname of that project, Modeling the Burning Bush at BYU. So we're trying to say, how does fire propagate through a bush of different kinds of species, right? And if there's wind or whatever, and so that's what we're working on right now, and the students are having fun with that.
And that helps firefighters know how to hopefully somewhat predict what the fire is doing.
That's what the goal is. We aren't quite there yet, but that's what we're aiming towards.
Well, it's a good goal because I remember the Great Yellowstone Fire of about, I think it was about 20 years ago. And then there was a lot of controversy about allowing that fire to burn. And since then, there have been other fires that have been allowed to burn in Yellowstone that have taken up thousands of acres.
Right.
But the following year after that, my family, we went on a little tour of the park. And it was just amazing that you would see a whole hillside of blackened stumps and one tree right in the middle of it that was green and growing.
Right.
Why does that happen?
I wish I knew. And fire is just, those big scale fires are just hard to predict. There's so many variables, and they create their own weather. They create their own wind. And so it's a very, very complex thing, and there's lots of very smart people trying to figure that out. And we're just a piece of that. One of the things with the Yellowstone area, it got so big they couldn't put it out. And it finally got put out by snow. Isn't that interesting?
Some months later.
Right. And there was even bigger fires that I was reading about. I went to a conference up in Spokane this year or in 2010, and they had some huge fires in Idaho. And I can't remember the years. It was in the early 1900s. And this is kind of the start of when they wanted to have the Forest Service start looking at real means of putting out fires. And there were lots of towns burned and thousands and thousands of acres of wood that the lumber industry wanted that got burned up. And so that was kind of the beginning of the Forest Service saying, let's do something productive here on managing fire. Now, in some cases, they did too good of a job because we try to put all the fires out. And what's happened over the years, and this is the state we're in now, is that all of the understory, so the bushes underneath the trees, have grown up too big. And so now we have these massive fires when there's a fire. The natural occurring fires would keep that burned away, so we'd have big pine trees with pine needles underneath but not a lot of bushes. But now, since we've been putting the fires out, all of these bushes have been growing up, and we call those ladder fuels, so that the fire can grow and then reach the tops of the trees, and then it becomes unmanageable. It's really hard to put out fires that are really huge that are in the tops of the trees.
Yeah.
Call those crown fires.
Yeah, they're a little out of reach.
Yeah.
So we've pointed out that unharnessed fire can be quite devastating.
Oh, yeah.
What do we need to be careful of in our workplaces, in our churches, in our homes?
Well, we're talking wildland fires, right? And so
right.
There's a difference between a home fire and a wildland fire. So for wildland fires, and they're not all man-caused, but lightning causes some. Arson causes some.
What?
Arson.
Arson.
So,
wow.
So a lot, maybe a significant portion, I don't know the number, 25 to 50% of the fires in Southern California are arson. So somebody wants to get their fire on the news. And so they go when the right conditions occur. And it's generally occurs when we have a high pressure in Utah in the winter or in the fall. And that creates winds, the Santa Ana winds, that go into Southern California. And once the winds start, if you light a fire, it's really hard to put the fire out. And
yeah.
And so, you know, arson is a big thing there. Or other carelessness, like dropping a cigarette or forest fire. We had that fire in the fall here in Utah, in southern end of Utah, or Salt Lake Valley, the Harriman fire, where the military was shooting, and it was on a day that was very windy, and they should not have been doing that. And the tracers from the machine guns started a fire, and it caused a big scare, burned a few homes. There was an even bigger fire, maybe three times as big, in central Utah going on, but it wasn't near the population center, so it didn't make a lot of press, and it didn't damage as many houses. So.
Yeah, but you can tell when everything finally settles out and the smoke settles and you wake up in the morning and you can hardly breathe.
Something's happened,
it's like, oh, that doesn't smell very good.
One of my friends when we were talking up at this conference in Spokane, said, you know, we started rating the size of a fire or the impact of the fire by the number of visits from the governor. So it may not be the biggest fire, but if the governor's been there two or three times, you know that it impacts something. So
yeah, and all fires do impact something.
If they're near population centers. But
yeah,
the biggest fires that we have in the United States are in Alaska, back in the wilderness, and they burn hundreds of thousands of acres every year. They're lightning caused generally, and they just don't do anything with them.
Because they're not really anywhere near.
Right, and it's natural, and nature puts them out too. So
that's true. That's true.
But now that we're living near the forest, and we want to manage that.
Okay, so now let's now move even a little closer to home.
Okay.
And into homes, because like I mentioned before, my house burned.
You had a fire, right?
Yeah, there was a fire in there.
Don't let kids play with matches, right?
So what can we do in our homes to make them a little less combustible?
Well, everything in the home is combustible. So it's not making it necessarily less combustible, but preventing an ignition event. So you don't want a fire to start. So if you're burning in your fireplace, you want to make sure that sparks don't come out and start your rug on fire. Or if you have children, you don't want them playing with matches. A number of fires happen around Thanksgiving where people have these turkey roasters in oil out on the barbecue, and they don't watch it because it takes a while, and the oil spills over, hits the flames from the barbecue and starts a big fire, starts the roof on fire, boils up the oil, and all of a sudden something is uncontrollable. Another one is cooking. So when you are cooking and you're frying something and there's grease and it's spattering around and it's too hot of temperature, that can start on fire and you can burn your whole kitchen up very quickly. So, you know,
I think even just minding where did you put the hot pad? Because
right.
Because if it's on a hot...
You put a hot pad on a burner, or put, you know, the wrong thing in the toaster, you can start a fire. So having a fire extinguisher, having a, a CO alarm or a smoke alarm maybe, but just being careful. And when something's hot, you know, don't put things in the microwave that shouldn't go in the microwave, like metal.
You know, or where it says, do not put anything flammable in front of this heater.
Right. And home heaters, they've been talking about that lately. And those have to be carefully attended. And you don't throw your socks on top of the heater or have your dog tip it over or something. And, it's the firefighters have lots of fire prevention kinds of things and checkups. But you just have to be vigilant.
You know, I think it's because energy is so convenient now. You just set the temperature in your home and everything just automatically works because of electricity.
Yeah.
Sometimes maybe we do get a little
complacent, yeah.
Complacent about, well, I'm just going to plug this in because this room's a little cold.
You have to get your furnace checked because if it gets older, there could be a leak and you could have a CO leak and then you could have a big problem. You could die.
Yeah.
Some friends of mine that were firefighters went camping and it was up in Montana, and they had two tents, one for the men, one for the boys, and their heater malfunctioned. They had a heater, and they were very experienced with it, but it malfunctioned, and they all got CO asphyxiation. And the boys, the teenagers, pulled them out of the tent, and they were all unconscious. They life-flighted them to Salt Lake.
Wow.
And one of them was in a coma for like two or three days. They put him in these hyperbaric chambers where they have oxygen at higher pressure to try to get the CO out of the system, and I think they're all doing okay. But what a scare, even for experienced people. So you have to be very careful.
Wow. So with all of your study in chemical engineering and combustion, has that shaped your view of the creation any?
My grandfather, Harvey Fletcher, used to always talk about science and religion, and he said he was in speech and hearing, and he studied how to make the first hearing aid, for instance. And he said, everything that I've learned about science has led me to believe that there is a creator. And I feel the same way. The scriptures say that the earth has enough and to spare. And energy-wise...
Excellent.
True, and I think that there's a purpose. So, you know, if you study energy, you know, it doesn't really lead you to God, I wouldn't say. But I think if you see the beauty and the scale of the creation, you say this could not have happened by itself. There has to be a plan, a master plan for us. And that's what I believe.
Excellent. When we talk about the second coming, we're told that according to Scripture, everything's going to burn.
That's true.
And
that the earth will become like glass. And when you think of it, a lot of the earth is like sand, and sand is what makes glass. So if it's burned high enough temperature, maybe that's how it's going to turn to glass.
That's an interesting thought. That's a very interesting thought. You're going to have to put your little combustion thinking cap on for that one.
I don't know. Talk to the geologist, too.
Oh. Well, Dr. Fletcher, thank you so much for being with us today. We appreciate it very much.
Well, it's great to be here. It was nice to meet you, and it's a privilege to be on this station with all of the notable people that have already been on here.
To our listening audience, thank you for joining us. Check us out at radio.lds.org. We invite you to listen to individual episodes of this or other programs and subscribe to receive podcasts of new episodes as they come available. And remember, three-year-old little brothers are smarter than you think they are. Make sure small children are out of the room when you put matches away. You've been listening to Insights on the Mormon Channel. I'm Marilee Stallings.